pase, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Wednesday. Yes, January 1st, 2020. How are you today? Happy New Year to everyone. How was your New Year's Eve, Dwayne?
It was epic, Kevin. It was an epic New Year's Eve. I've had a few of them, so they just all blend at some point. So let's go with epic.
Yeah, it was epic. Me too. It was amazing. The ball drop. Everything was great. Champagne at midnight. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what happened on New Year's Eve. And we hope that you're enjoying your New Year's Day with us here on Soccer Today. Our top 10 Canadian soccer moments or stories of the 2010s. That's quite a eventful decade in Canada soccer, maybe the most eventful decade in its history. It's hard to tell, but it was truly an epic decade in soccer in Canada.
Yeah, and at the risk of making myself sound older than I am, this is actually the second time that I have created a top 10 decade moment. I, of course, have been blogging for a few years. At the end of the 2000s, no one knows. We don't know what to call the 10s yet, so we sure as hell don't know what to call the first half of the decade.
At least we're good for the 20s. It's going to be the 20s. That's easy. It's an easy one. The 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. We're good for the next 80 years.
I think I'm probably good. Not to be dark, but I don't think I'll be in the 2100s. But you know, we'll see.
Technology can change. This show just went like truly dark and like really in a dark place. Dwayne just contemplated his mortality. But let's talk about Canadian soccer.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, to paraphrase Drake, as we often do on the show, it is a decade that most certainly started from the bottom.
We hit the bottom for sure during that decade.
Yeah, and look, as a preamble to it, the 2010, there's three women's World Cups, three men's World Cups in any 10-year cycle, right? And it just so happened that, of course, we'll be talking about two men's World Cup qualifying campaigns in Canada and three women's World Cups in this decade, and then the Olympics as well. So they're all kind of included in this this list. The 2010 World Cup in South Africa, Canada, you know, as much as we point to a moment, an infamous moment in this decade as being the lowest of the low points, and I think most of us can agree with that. In reality, for those of us that remember the 2010 qualifying process, that was a much bleaker situation. They only had 2 points in the semifinal arranged. They famously blew a game against Jamaica at home, and it was the first time there had been a pro-Canadian crowd in years in Canada, the first game at BMO Field for the men's national team, and Pat Onstad punched the ball in his own net. And any chances.
Oh, how do you describe Canada soccer in a nutshell? Like that.
Yeah, exactly. And this is Pat Onstad when he's winning MLS, you know, playoff MVP awards. So not exactly a bad player at any rate. So that's where we started from. And where we end today, you know, we're not going to say now we're here. Well, we are here. What here is, well, we'll see. And it is kind of in a moment of change is on the horizon, I think. And I think that that's the most exciting thing as we enter the 20s, is it does certainly seem like Canadian soccer is going to evolve further in this decade and become something. We don't know what yet. And that's the exciting part about sports always.
Yep, is that we don't know where it is actually going because it's not truly scripted, even though sometimes it feels like it is, but it's not. Honorable mentions before we get started with our top 10 Canada soccer moments or Canadian soccer moments of the 2010s. Honorable mention to the League One Ontario and PLSQ emerging and being created in the 2010s and clearly establishing themselves as a provincial D3 or even Canadian D3 when you look at it, but clear Division 3 in Canada with the League One Ontario PLSQ that has grown over the last 5 years, both of those entities. But yes, it is a honorable mention for sure.
Yeah, and look, we've had Dino Rossi, the commissioner of League One Ontario, on here many times. I would call Dino a friend on a personal level as well. And I think what they've accomplished in League One Ontario is quite remarkable in a short period of time. It laid the groundwork at a lower level, at a lower scale, for what had to happen to create the Canadian Premier League, and it's an important stepping stone along the way. And as we saw with the first year of the Canadian Premier League, with an astronomical amount of players that came through that system, and the PLSQ, I think, is going to be the same in days ahead. I think it was underrepresented in the Canadian Premier League this year, and was certainly, especially the way Blainville played in the Barclays Cup game, would indicate that we'll see more of those players soon. And I think it's an important level of the system that needs to evolve further. Talk of a league starting in BC soon. Hopefully, you know, with this league that the Saskatchewan folks and Foothills are talking about, maybe that can serve as a prayer version. And I think we'd all like to see this become a CHL, to use the hockey analogy of soccer. And I think that would be a perfectly unique and good Canadian interpretation of how the world works and how the world evolves. And although it wouldn't be exactly like the rest of the world, it doesn't have to be, as long as it works.
Well, the CHL is not exactly like other hockey leagues in the world, is it? And it's whatever works for you. And that is one. The other honorable mention we wanted to say before we get going with our top 10 is the CONCACAF Champions League run of the Montreal Impact in 2015 and Toronto FC in 2018. Those two runs to the final being beaten by a Mexican giant in each case. Montreal lost to Club America in the final. And famously, Toronto lost to Chivas Guadalajara, with now manager of San Jose Earthquakes, Matias Almeida, as a manager of Chivas when they beat Toronto. But two great runs to the final of the CONCACAF Champions League by two Canadian teams this decade.
Yeah, look, behind the curtain, when we created the list, this was the last one that was chopped out of the 10. I just simply felt that there were other things we'll talk about here, which speaks to the overall things that a run like this creates. But certainly, both were exciting moments on their own, both a little bit different with similarities, and they both created excitement in the game, which is ultimately what matters. You know, you could argue, and I will continue to have this discussion in the few ahead of here, that MLS moments shouldn't be in a Canadian list, but I think bluntly you'd be wrong. There are three MLS teams in this country, and they all have a significant impact on the game.
And the CONCACAF Champions League has nothing to do with MLS. Canada team, well, the Canadian team qualifies with the Canadian Championship. So it had nothing to do with Major League Soccer when we look at the CONCACAF Champions League, and that's what we forget sometimes.
Yeah, exactly, and they were exciting moments. I just thought that there was better examples with more important things that the MLS teams did this decade that deserved to be in a top 10 ranked over these two runs. Had one of them won it, then we'd be having a different conversation.
Well, yeah, because it would be like high up there probably. Go from not even making the list to like top five of the list. But speaking of the list, let's go, Dwayne. We both have the same list in front of us. We work together, mostly you, with this list. Let's start with number 10, the Impact and the Whitecaps becoming Major League Soccer team. 2011 for the Vancouver Whitecaps, 2012 for the Montreal Impact. Canada went from one to three teams in Major League Soccer, and it started with Vancouver in 2011 and Canada in 2012. Montreal 2012, sorry.
Yeah, look, and it probably would have been reversed had Joey just been quiet for a while, but that's a different topic that's a long time past now. Look, I know that there are people outside of the MLS markets that feel that the MLS markets overwhelm them and that they don't get their due course, particularly the CAMPL fans now, thinking that, you know, all the national media attention goes to the MLS teams and they get to, you know, get the short end of the stick, so to speak. And I get that sentiment, but look, you cannot underestimate the value and the importance of Major League Soccer teams in Canada. They helped bring this sport to the mainstream. I'm sorry, but even, you know, the Christine Sinclair great moments in London and Rio, they helped to a certain extent. Anything the Canadian men's national team has done in the past little bit, beating the U.S., that helps to a certain extent. But really what has driven this sport from truly niche to being a mainstream sport in Canada, and I think it is now. Is there a question? Is it a niche sport in Canada anymore? I don't think so. I think it's part of the daily sports absorption of most fans. And, you know, some may like it more than others, but it's part of the mainstream now. No one argues otherwise. No one's talking about it being a sport of the future. It's here. And the reason to me it's here is because MLS came up here and gave people in the three biggest cities in this country, two of which starting this decade, something that engaged them day after day, and not just occasionally. that importance, that value of having that hometown team at a league that is perceived to be at the very highest. And, you know, I know that there are some that would kind of look nostalgically back on the USL days or the A-League days and kind of wish that they could have that intimacy back again. But you're being a little selfish when you're having those thoughts. That's okay. You're allowed to, but don't wish it into existence, because the sport just wasn't the same when that level was the best we have. And it's for the best that these teams are here. And it allows, I think, I like our system now with the Canadian Premier League there to have the development and give an opportunity to Canadian players and be focused on the Canadian part of it. And then also have this higher level that allows us to feel a little more connected to the elite level of the sport worldwide. I think it's a perfect compromise, a perfect Canadian solution, and something I wouldn't want to see go away. I don't want to see the MLS teams leave. I don't want to see MLS leave Canada. I don't. And I think that it was valuable and vital that those two teams came in to not make it all about Toronto, because a lot of the country resents that, to give something for everyone in this country, whether you're, you know, mostly whether you're Quebec or French speaking. Outside of Quebec, you have your impact. If you're a Western Canadian, you have the Whitecaps. And, you know, if you're the one quarter of the country that loves Toronto, then you got your TFC, right? It's something for everyone. And the rest of the three quarters have something to hate too. So it's good.
For 9 of the top 10 Canadian moments of the decade in soccer, TFC wins first MLS Cup by a Canadian team back in 2017 after losing in 2016. Toronto FC goes back against Seattle once again in their second ever MLS Cup hosted in Toronto in 2017 also, and TFC wins with a Josie Altidore goal and becomes the first MLS Canadian team to win Major League Soccer, the first time that a non-American team wins the Philip F. Anschutz Trophy.
And look, I can hear the screaming coming from Vancouver and Montreal right now as they listen to this, that we are being Toronto-centric, which is hilarious since Kevin's in Montreal. Here is what I will say to that. Earlier this year, there was a Twitter thing that was going around, which was name a controversial opinion that you'll defend. And my controversial opinion was soccer opinions in this particular case, you would vary it, like name a controversial political opinion you'll defend or whatever. But someone said, name a controversial Canadian soccer question or opinion you'll defend. And mine was the TFC's success was good for was good overall for the Canadian soccer scene. And I will stick to that. It drives popularity. It drives, just like the Raptors winning is good for Canadian basketball. Like, I don't know how you can deny that. TFC is not everyone's team in this city, in this country. I get it. The Raptors aren't everyone's team in this country. The Raptors aren't even everyone's team in Toronto. They're most people's team in Toronto, but they're not everyone's team in Toronto, right? It helps to drive the popularity and the visibility of the game to have a big moment like that. And even them going back to the final this year, you can kind of include that too. It was kind of a surprise run, but it didn't have the same hype as the first one, because I think that it was so unexpected, right? And the playoffs are different now too, in terms of the rapid fireness nature of them. But that run in the playoffs in 2017, coming off the 2016 run where there was momentum already, was the end of like a two-part epic series. You know, we joked in the countdown of the MLS top 10 moments that, you know, TFC versus Seattle part 3, but it kind of almost seems separate this year. Those 2 years back-to-back really did put the sport front and center, did make TSN really set up and take note. They don't have a lot of properties left, TSN, right? So they might as well take care of the ones they have. And they have, in my opinion, given MLS much greater attention, much greater focus since TFC got good.
And dedication, you know, I would say, because it's even Montreal and Vancouver also. Like, it never used to be part of the example Sports Center, and now it is. Montreal loses or wins or TFC, and they try not to be just TFC because they know they're in Toronto. They know that their reputation is Toronto focused, so they actually try to make sure that they cover a little bit of Vancouver and a little bit of Montreal. When I say a little bit, it's like one sentence per show, if that even. But when they do talk about soccer, they usually try to talk about MLS at least a bit more than before.
Exactly, and it all stems from that, and it's all pushing that sort of the attention barometer here. And also, if I can be local for a minute, in the market I'm in, which is one-third of the population of this country, it was a massive story. It was the first championship that Toronto had found at what they would call
how I put it, it's the first championship in a cross-border league that, you know, you get into all the caveats because then does lacrosse count and all that. But no, this one felt different. It felt like a legitimate championship coming to Toronto. It was an appetizer. It was our garlic bread and cheese to the Raptors' main course, no doubt. That was a whole other level. But it did matter. The people were packing the bars that night. There was a parade that was, you know, a quarter of the size of the Raptors parade, but it was a quarter of the size of the Raptors parade.
Exactly. Which is still like 500,000 people, because it was over 2 million for the Raptors parade. But no, you're just trying to illustrate the point. But yes, TFC winning in 2017 Major League Soccer, the MLS Cup. It is a Canadian soccer moment for sure of the decade. Let's be real. When's the last time a Canadian soccer team won anything?
1979.
Well, no. Well, 2009, the Impact in ASL. Well,
okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. At what A-League. Is considered the top tier one, right?
Yeah.
I was going back to the Soccer Bowl of the Whitecaps. So we've hit them all right there. All three have been mentioned now. So no one can accuse this of bias. But it doesn't happen often is the point. And, you know, national team, we can talk, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about bronze medals soon. I mean, how could we not? I don't think that's much of a spoiler.
Yeah, no, but I don't think there's spoilers. People are aware of where we're going.
Yeah, this was a big moment for the overall game. It was a bigger moment for Toronto soccer, but Toronto is in Canada. You know, regardless of what you want to think of Toronto, the city, and I know a lot of you like to enjoy bashing it, but the Toronto stories are Canadian stories, and it was a Canadian story, and it certainly is deserving to be on the list, and we put it at 9th, which is the right place for it.
Number 8, the transfer of off. Okay, granted, the transfer and the announcement happened in 2018, but let's phrase it this way. The breakthrough of Alphonso Davies with Bayern Munich in 2019 is our 8 stories of the year, number 8, because it is amazing. He's maybe the best left back in the Bundesliga right now, which means he's one of the best left backs in the world playing for a 19-year-old at the highest level. Well, he just turned 20. At a high level, like the highest level we've seen, he might be, by the end of all of this, the best soccer product coming out of Canada in the history of sports.
Yeah, and, you know, we've done a lot of shows today, so we'll forgive Kevin for this, but this is the decade list, so that's why the transfer is the story. But
oh, yeah, but yes, yeah. Jesus, yeah, and I have a cold, but no, it is it's true. It is a decade list, right? Okay, so yeah, never mind. But it still stands what I'm saying. It's still an amazing story.
Yes, it's a recent story, too, and, you know, we always, when we're doing decade lists, struggle with recency bias, both to not overstate the nearer stuff and understate the later stuff, right? Something I tried, I think, on this list to do and very well. But you can't ignore what's happened over the past 18 months with Alphonso Davies and how it's symbolic of this new generation of young Canadian players that came up in the MLS era. They came of age when MLS was established here. And I really view, you know, when I did the last list, so the O's list, I talked about TFC joining, and we talked already on this list about Montreal and Vancouver joining, and this is why. These players came through when this was the reality, and I think it allowed them to flourish. Alphonso Davies was always going to be pro. He had the talent, some of them found him. But having the ability to turn pro at, what was it, 14? Would have been different.
Well, yeah, and it also, well, yeah, it's true with Edmonton and when with Vancouver, and it's also in this era, like, yes, back then we used to say, if you're good enough, doesn't matter where, someone will find you, but it might find you too late. And he's a perfect example of finding him at the right perfect time and having... He got criticized at that moment, at that time, but Kyle Robinson did do it properly, how he handled the playing time for Alphonso Davies. And the more he grew, like, the playing time will grow with the confidence, but anyways, I'm just saying, there's a lot of good things that happened in Alphonso Davies, and yes, it's a generational talent, and it's an outlier talent. You won't have 5 Alphonso Davies per province per year. You'll have one maybe in your entire life. But once you have him, don't fuck it up, and they haven't fucked it up yet.
This is what happens if Alphonso Davies is 10 years older than he is. He ends up at probably one of the A-League teams when he's about 18. And you know, he's too talented to go to the NWSL. Someone takes him away from that. He probably plays 1 or 2 years in at the A-T league level and does very well because he's his age, right? He's not as good as he is now, but he's still very talented. He then goes to probably Belgium or Greece or Portugal lower tier and maybe gets found by a mid-level team. He might end up at Benfica. Yeah, 23. That's Alfonso Davies' journey 10 years ago. Because he has MLS and because he has the attention and the ability to get professional training from the time he's 13, 14 years old all the way through, now he's at Bayern Munich. That is a difference. And then the other part of that, of course, is that players that aren't as talented as him do end up at, you know, mid-level European leagues, yeah. Right? And that's good, too.
But also, nowadays, the passport, the Canadian passport, doesn't affect you that much. And I was talking earlier this week, getting the documentary ready, by the way, if you're listening to this on January 1st, couple days, 1 or 2 maximum, and the documentary will be out. All the interviews have been done. We're just putting things together in the audio files. But Carlo Carrezan, Golden Boot of the 2000 Gold Cup. I was talking to him last night, and I was saying, Carlo, how did the fact having a Canadian passport, did it hinder you? He's like, well, you know what? I got an Italian passport. And that's one of the only reasons why I had a shot in the mid-90s and early 2000s. So imagine Alfonso Davies came in 20 years before and having at 16, 17... To go to Europe with a Canadian passport? No, he would never had a shot. So yeah, no, it does illustrate how Canadian soccer has progressed. Not necessarily only here, because result-wise, it's hard to argue that we have actually progressed that hard. But at least in the perception of the minds of people at decision-making jobs that are allowing Canadians to come through development programs. We're looking at Leon Millar. We're looking at others. I was going to mention Fraser Aird, but with the recent development that happened today, I might not mention Fraser Aird. Okay, you don't know the story. Fraser Aird actually did the wanker sign to Celtics fans as a not even a Rangers player. He plays for the Cove Rangers, but actually he doesn't anymore. He got released. Played. Yeah, he got released because of his gesture. But anyways, I'm just saying that Alfonso Davies in this decade was able to break through to the top team of the best team in one of the best leagues in the world, Bayern Munich. And that would have been very difficult 20 years ago.
Book it right now. Fraser Aird's going to end up at Forge. We'll see how that plays out.
Forge or somewhere else in the Canadian Premier League.
Yeah, he's local to that area. That's why I said Forge. But yeah, absolutely. That is the emergence and the ability of those players. And Jonathan David, you could put it on another side, and we could talk about this in different levels. I'm even going to include Kyle Lahren a little bit in this. I know he hasn't panned out exactly the way we would have liked, but he, in some ways, because of the age difference, is an example of the final echo of the previous era where he went through the NCAA program, and I think that held him back.
And Generation Adidas, right? That did not help him. But anyways.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, had he been doing that when he was 18 rather than 23, maybe he's having the struggles a little bit less than he is now. And, yeah, it's a lot of things. Like, Jonathan David's a better example because he used the connections that he had through his agent to get into Europe and get that opportunity, which is, I think, you know, this is just an evolution to continue. It's sort of an example of what's happening now in the Canadian system, that there is a system finally. We can talk about improving systems. Folks, 10 years ago, there wasn't a system. It was just throw shit against the wall.
Yep, and whenever it used to work, you're like, okay, we do more of this. But yeah, that's our number 8 in our top 10 moments or stories, soccer stories, in Canada in the 2010s. Number 7, John Herdman going from 2 bronze medal performances as manager of the Canadian Women's National Team to manager of the Canadian Men's National Team. Switching teams for John Herdman, number 7.
It, in a much, much lower level within the context of Canada versus the rest of the world. So keep this in mind as I'm saying this. John Herdman is our version of Jose Mourinho in the fact that he garners so much attention and so much talking points and so much, he's so visible all the time, and he knows how to take care of his personal brand. So John Herdman okay, is so really what the story is here, I think.
The smiling one. Come on.
It has to be the smiling one. The smiling one or the medium shirt one. It's, yeah, he is a guy that has managed to really ingrain himself in all aspects of Canadian soccer. And for better or worse, he is the future of Canadian soccer in this for the next few years, right? And that switch to me is the epitome, his pinnacle moment, the day that it announced he was taking over the men's team. This was entirely not something that would have happened anywhere else. We'll say that. And I think that it's a unique situation in this environment that he has figured out how to navigate in better than anyone else. I don't think John Herdman's a bad coach, for the record. I think he's a decent coach. I just don't think he's, you know, God's gift to coaching that some do, particularly some in the Canadian Soccer Association. But you cannot argue that he is brilliant at maintaining his image and at finding ways to stumble upwards.
Well, what,
and here we are.
Yeah, but Dwayne, what's, how do you get these jobs, right? How do you differentiate yourself from another one? It's all about how you sell your brand, how you're able to convince someone to give you an opportunity. So that's all it is. Like, and that is a talent unto itself. And having John Herdman being able to have the Canadian Soccer Association, and of course, there's a lot more to that story, and maybe one day we'll go deep into how this all went down from Benito Floro to Octavio Zambrano to John Herdman. There's a lot of things that happened behind the scenes in those three coaching changes. But that does illustrate that sometimes the best talent that you need to get into a position like this, and I don't mean any disrespect to John Herdman, by the way, is to be able to sell yourself and convince someone to give you an opportunity. And once you have that opportunity, you have to succeed. You have to be good. Otherwise, you're putting yourself out there. Your neck is out there, and it's easy to be chopped. But John Herdman got himself a long leash just by beating the United States in his second year at the helm of the Canadian men's national team. But the switching of teams, that would have probably never happened in any other country in the world. But the way it happened and with the result that followed, you know, one of my first bosses in life used to tell me, Kevin, because guess what? I used to talk a lot for some reason. I think I still do. But he says, your boots got to follow your lips. So, tes bottines faut suivre les babines. So your boots got to follow your lips and then you'll get things done. So John Herdman's boots have actually followed his lips.
Very good. Yeah, quickly, folks, if you are listening to this, Oz was not fired because John Herdman forced him out. He was fired because he didn't handle the money very well. That story is out there in enough places I can say it. But it's, yeah, John Herdman got that job without interviewing, really, though. And that tells you that he has a lot of power within the Canadian Soccer Association. So for better or worse, in a general sense, John Herdman is on our list of top 10 Canadian soccer moments of the decade.
Number six of our top 10 soccer moments of the decade, hosting the 2015 Women's World Cup, the biggest Women's World Cup in the history of Women's World Cup at that moment in 2015. And no, Canada did not win it. No, it wasn't our best performance on the field, but it was well done, well put together, and it was a World Cup hosted in Canada in 2015.
One round further than we did in France. Look, Canada did exactly what you would have expected them to do based on the overall talent level there. I understand that no one in this country that didn't follow the game week in, week out understood that. It didn't matter how much I screamed it from the rooftop. You know, my, at the time, 6,000 followers on Twitter understood my position. No one else did, though, so it's fine, though. Look, I think it's important for a lot of levels, and I think that the hosting successfully the 2015 Women's World Cup was the first step that led eventually to groups believing that soccer could be something that you could sell outside of the major cities. You know, a group was in Winnipeg, for instance. There was a group in Moncton, although there was infrastructure issues out there. They still got attendance and still people went. It sort of showed that the game would be watched by general Canadians outside of the big cities that didn't have a connection to some club back home, quote-unquote home, right? And I think that was important. You know, just as, you know, 2007 TFC showed that the big cities would come out in big numbers to watch a domestic club team in this country, I think the the Women's World Cup showed that the smaller cities would come out in big numbers to watch soccer that they deemed worthwhile watching. And that in turn led to investing groups being interested in investing in the game further. And here we are in 2019 with the league. And this is all important stuff. On a sporting level too, it's just important that we further created the superstar level of attention that people like Christine Sinclair received in this country. Christine Sinclair started this decade as someone that soccer geeks knew and respected. And she ends this decade as maybe, well, Bianca would be the most famous Canadian and Brooke Henderson would be the two most famous Canadian athletes, female athletes right now, probably. She third? Maybe. Yeah, 5 years ago, was she first? Well, maybe,
yeah, because Kayla Humphries isn't Canadian anymore, so that also helps. But no, I totally understand your point.
Yeah, she's famous. She's a household name. There are people beyond sports that understand who Christine Sinclair is. And, you know, she's not Sidney Crosby in this country yet, but for anyone outside of a hockey player to do that in Canada, they'd have to do something beyond the game. But in terms of what is happening with the game, she is absolutely a star right now, and that happened in this decade.
It did happen in this decade, and the World Cup has a lot to do with it in 2015. Number 5 of the Canadian soccer moments of the 2010s, the USA game in London, Canada-USA. Canada lost, but in our heart, they won.
1, 2, 3, 4, villains and heroes created that day. The day that soccer became part of the national narrative in a way that it never had before, Kevin. That was maybe the most positive feeling loss in Canadian soccer history. Because I do remind people from time to time that we did, in fact, lose the game 4-3 on the late goal.
Very weird and direct free kick. Let's not forget that the 6 seconds.
Direct free kick tied the game, and then they scored the game with a header in stoppage time, but or in extra time. But yeah, look, that was what I was nodding to off the top of my counting. Abby Wambach was counting that Aaron McLeod was holding the ball too long in the box, and they called a foul that's never called at any level like this ever. You know, people will go, "Well, it's in the rules." They're the same people that like millimeter offside calls and want to shake them.
The same people who calls all the traveled in basketball, looking at LeBron James. They walked 5.5 step. That's a travel.
Yeah, it was a dumb, bad call by our inexperienced referee. I don't want to throw the woman under the bus any further, the Norwegian referee, as people like to call her here. She was in over her head, and that is the fault of the people that put her in the position, not her. And it was a bad call, but you know, as I said, she was pressured by by Abby Wambach, and she made the call, and it led to a goal that should not have counted. They should not have gotten that opportunity. I'll say it bluntly. Canada was robbed that game, and that actually probably made it better for the overall narrative of the game. Because had they won that game, obviously they would have won a silver medal in the Olympics, at minimum, if they had not managed to win the gold medal game. I actually forget who did win the silver that year. Do you remember? I don't have the top of my head.
Japan losing against the States?
Yeah, I think it might have. I don't know.
It's all blends. Japan won the one before. Anyways, it's all blends.
That's World Cup, but
Olympics. Yeah, I don't know. I don't.
Yeah, we'd have to look it up, but which tells you a lot. What we remember about that game is the game against the United States. I mean, there's a lot of Canadians probably don't even remember the bronze game.
France finished fourth. I know that. In 2012.
Canada beat France in the bronze medal game. That's Diana Matheson scored late in stoppage time. Kellen Kyle jumped out of the way. Probably would be called offside by VAR now.
Yep.
So yeah,
maybe we don't have that bronze medal with VAR, but yes, continue.
Yes, exactly. But the overall, that whole tournament and those that week in London, since these games in London, but the semifinal game in particular, just created, like I said, a narrative that was profoundly important to Canadian soccer fans, and it came really on the heels. Here's another important thing too, and I don't want to compare mixing the men's and women's games up too much, but in this case I think it's relevant to point out how close it came from the loss in San Pedro Sula. They won that game, so mentally to have the Canadian women stand up and like give us a little bit of pride back with that run was remarkable. And on a personal level, I think maybe the bronze medal game against France when Diana Matheson scored the goal to give Canada a bronze medal, and they're celebrating on the field with their flags and all that sort of stuff. I can remember having like an emotional welling in my eyes then that I don't normally get. Like, I'm too callous from having watched too much. It's rare that the sport takes me there anymore, but it did that day because it was like, oh my God, I've been following this program for 20 years and they actually have something to celebrate. Like, actually, you know, it's a bronze medal, not a gold medal, but you know, I'm not one of those second places, a first place loser idiots out there. I understand how amazing of an accomplishment that is, particularly for a country that's never been that high before, really. And for them to follow it up later on was amazing too. But in that day, the day, that semifinal day, was just, it was everything. And it's probably the best game of the decade, I think, for many people, despite the fact that it ended in a loss.
Yeah,
but Canadians like to have the chip on their shoulder too when it comes to the States. So in some ways, losing the way they did almost helped.
Yeah, it helps us portray ourselves as the nice guys and yeah, the bad guys and the villains and the heroes, right? Let's continue. Number four, following the London performance with another bronze medal, this time in Rio. This one was never really in doubt. It wasn't as surprising, but Canada, back-to-back bronze in the Olympics, this time in 2016 in Rio.
And another way to put it, it's the bronze medal they deserved. Look, I'm not being cute here. Canada in London did not have a great tournament overall. What they had in London was...
They finished third of the damn group.
Yeah, they finished third in the group. They had a very good game in the quarterfinals against Team GB, the host nation, and eliminated what was mostly England. That was the one great game they played in the tournament. The semifinals, as I said, they lost. And then they I don't know how the hell they won the game against France. That was Seattle v. TFC 2016.
Well, it wasn't today's France. That's the big difference too. It was 2012 France, which is very different than 2016 or 2020 France.
Yeah, that said, France 2012 outshot Canada 20-1 that day, and lost 1-0. It was, you know, soccer's a weird game. And that happened, and it happened to benefit Canada on the day. You know, 20 other times it doesn't happen, but it did. So bronze medal it was. But in Rio, they started the tournament with a great win against Sweden. I will always remember that game more than any other, because I was traveling back to my parents in Belleville, and it's 2 days before the Olympics start. We're doing a show. We start T-minus 2 days. It was the very first day of competition in the Rio Games, 2 days before the opening ceremony.
And she scored like a minute in, right, or something?
Yeah, and I was at the train station in Belleville. I think I was traveling home from my parents, actually. So I was at the train station in Belleville trying to watch it on the screen in the train station. And he's like, oh, my God, they scored. Because I was waiting to get it on my phone until I got on the train because I didn't want to use my Wi-Fi, my data up, right? So anyways, I have memories of how they work, and they ended up having a very good game. And I remember talking about that on Five Rings after, and then they just rolled, and they, you know, obviously they beat Germany in that tournament. First time they ever beat Germany in a competitive game, topped the group. They came up short against Germany in the semifinals. And if you remember too, the way the draw worked out for some reason, it was really one-sided. So Canada had to beat Germany again to get back to a final, and they couldn't get past them that day. Germany ended up winning the gold medal. USA eliminated in the quarterfinals there, so it seemed like it might have been a bit of a lost opportunity. But nonetheless, they drew France again in that bronze medal game, and this time they deserved to win the game. It was a very good performance, top to bottom. I will maintain, not only this decade, I think it's the best tournament performance by a Canadian team ever in Rio. And it was, to me, as a purist, better tournament than London. I know emotionally London is a more important moment for a lot of people, but to me as a soccer guy, Rio was the defining moment of the Canadian women's national team program this past decade.
A repeat performance when people are expecting it versus an unanticipated victory, or at least a performance when there's no expectations, are two different things. And we saw the same results, just in a two different fashion. So those two moments are clearly big stories in our decade, number five and number four, for the Rio one. Sinclair winning the Lumarsh flag bearer. It was for Rio, if I believe, correct? Or was it London?
London. It was London. The Lumarsh winner in 2012, yeah.
Okay, so Lumarsh winner in 2012, flag bearers for the 2012 closing ceremony in London, yeah. Sinclair. And that moment is so rare to have a soccer player winning the Lou Marsh. Sinclair did it. And in that year was a very big story. And it qualifies as our top three stories of the decade.
Yeah. It's a chance to talk about Christine Sinclair. Which you have to talk about in the global sense of the conversation. That was her defining, you know, her peak moment. She's at the pinnacle of her skills at that point. The hat trick in the semifinal against the States, she almost personally won the game for us. Flag bearer, as I said, in the closing ceremonies, that's a big deal. That means that you were the athlete that most captured the imagination of Canadians during an Olympic Games. And that's, you know, we're a nation that gets into Olympic Games, right? Every 2 years, there's someone emerges. And this one time, finally, it was a soccer player. Lou Marsh Award, for those that don't know, that are listening outside of Canada, that is our athlete of the year in Canada. And it's just a, that's athlete of the year. And there's no other qualifications to it. So you define it how you wish. So it's a very interesting debate that, that is had every year in December, is Bianca this year. Winning the US Open. It was kind of a slam dunk win this year.
Yeah, this year was a unanimous vote.
Yeah, and it, that's only happened one other time before in recent memory, and that was Steve Nash. So you have to do something at a world level that's easily defined as being the pinnacle of your sport to do that. Sinclair won it, though, and it's the only, you said it was rare. It's rare in the sense that it was the only time it's ever happened. A soccer player won it, a female soccer player won it, and it elevated her from, as I said, niche performer that soccer geeks liked to superstar. And to this day, you know, she's, yeah, Hayley Wickenheiser, Christine Sinclair, like they're buddies because they know each other and they know what each other has done. They have lifted their sport into the mainstream and have become stars in this country in a way that no other, that rarely female athletes in team sports have ever done before. And that's significant. And I think that we have to pull Sinclair herself out from the rest of the team. We have to separate her a little bit and talk about her as being one of the defining moments of the decade throughout the decade. And it's too bad she didn't end it on top of the all-time leading scorer list, but she will. We all recognize that she will get the record soon.
She'll play until she gets the record. How about that? I have a feeling that's going to happen.
She only needs a couple now. So it's, yeah.
But yeah, I know it will happen. All right, so that's our number three soccer moment in the 2010s. Number two Canadian moments of the entire decade. Which one could it be? There's only two left, Wayne. So, you know, so I think our listeners are anticipating which one is number one, and you'll learn soon. But number two, drum roll, please. Sure, that's a drum.
Bad drum, yeah.
Drum spat. Number two, the launch of the Canadian Premier League. Finally, one of the last developed country, if not the last developed country in the world, to have its own professional soccer league.
Yeah, it's the of the G20, it's the last league for sure. We talked about this on our year-end list this year, because unfortunately it took till 2019 to get it done, so it was in this past calendar year. So if you listen to our year-end list on Soccer Today, you can hear us talk in more detail, but it's obviously a very important landmark for this nation to get the league started. And you know, if I was to boil it down, I was at the first game. I didn't quite make the last game. I was at the second last game of the year. And in between several games, it was just what I found nice about it was about halfway through the year when all of the hype around the first day and the excitement around that had worn off, and it was just about going out to watch games. And I remember one day traveling up, getting up in the morning, having breakfast and jumping on the subway to go up to watch York 9 play. I forget who they were playing. I think it was Pacific maybe. And that game was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I watched that game. And then I got back on the subway and I went down to BMO Field and I watched TFC play someone at 6 o'clock. And I remember thinking to myself, this feels real. I'm in a city that has, and like, I think the week before I'd watched Forge play. So within a week I'd watched, I'd been in three different professional soccer stadiums watching professional soccer teams play in the city of Toronto. And I, you know, hope one day that number can go from 3 to 5 to 6 and you could have that experience that the rest of the world has, that just have the ability to wake up in the morning, get on a subway, watch a professional lower level league, because that's what it is right now, and enjoying it for it is, and then going down and watching the big club, so to speak, a little bit later. That's how the world works, and we have it here finally. It's going to take a few more years to get it up to the numbers we like, but it mattered that it got there. And, you know, on a personal level, I reported the story from 2014 is when I first started to write about it, to see it actually go up and the ups and downs of that and being told I was lying and accused of making it up for, in some cases, to actually see it come to the to fruition and, you know, to see this whole evolution of CanPL bloggers and podcasters that really are completely organic and away from the MLS guys, you know, a new generation. Just like I know what the generation, like the, you know, there's a whole bunch of, we called them MLS 1.0 bloggers that had, when blogging had more barriers, you had to know HTML and you had to have a little more skills technically to get online back in the your early parts of the 2000s and that.
Mid-2000s, yeah. And,
yeah, before Blogger came out, basically. And then when the blogger era bloggers came through, like Jason Davis, myself, people like that, we were the MLS 2.0 bloggers and we were like the new kids on the block, right? And not to give myself too much credit here, but it almost feels like these CanPL guys, it reminds me of me back then, 10 years ago. Like you're hustling and writing and it's fun and it's, I love to see it.
You see yourself in other people. That's nice.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice.
So 10 years, 10 years from now, they'll all be podcasting.
10 years from now, they'll all be like disillusioned.
I don't even know how many shows we've done today now. I think I've just been talking all day,
basically. Oh, yeah. Well, there's a few. All right. It's time. Our number one Canadian soccer moment of the decade. You know exactly where we're going. It's not a fun one. We never said that the top 10 moments or stories have to be good stories. No. We ate to be that person. We ate to be the one to do it to you. But we got to remember a certain night in San Pedro Sula because it still hurts.
Yeah. Look, here I am. I'm looking at my clock at little behind the curtain. We're recording this on New Year's Eve. So it's the last day of the 2019s as I'm sitting there staring at my clock and this still haunts us. We still talk about it all the time. As much as we always say, this is the last time we're going to talk about 8-1. It never ends up being that way, and it won't until we make a World Cup, bluntly. Or go back down there and win.
We needed a point. We were a freaking point away from the hex. We were just a point away from the hex. They even touched the post 3 minutes in. It was 0-0. And touched the post. Man, it was so close.
It's goes a funny later. Game.
It goes later.
It's a funny game because, look, there was lots of moments within the semifinal phase, too, that could have seen them have that point previously, and they were in that position to get there, and we don't know what would happen in the hex. I happen to think they probably might not have been pretty in the hex. They might not have, you know, we sometimes think that had they shown up that day and gotten their draw that maybe they would have made a World Cup, but to me, I look at the 8-1, and it really exposed a lot of things that maybe needed to be exposed, and this is how I've always positively spun this. I don't know if we are where we are without the 8-1. Had they gotten a draw in San Pedro Sula and they gone to the hex and finished fifth, say, you know, they win a game against Jamaica and they lose their, you know, draw another game and lose the rest and they finish well out of the World Cup spots in fifth or sixth place in the hex, we probably, at least at the highest levels, are like, okay, well, we made a hex. That's an advancement. We don't need to change anything. And maybe the impetus to change, the impetus to pushing the envelope further and further and trying to outlandish ideas like starting a league, don't happen. We're starting League One Ontario. Don't happen. But because of 8-1, that's the other part of it, too, is that people like Dino Rossi, who we've talked about already in this show, you know, you talk about that next generation of leadership coming up. Well, Dino would be part of that generation that sort of came from the later part of the last decade that sort of found each other through the democratization of the sport, like through access to each other online and blogging and TFC and all that sort of stuff. That's how he emerged. And, you know, he's obviously doing a lot with him and he's an outlier in many ways. But that whole Ben Rycroft, too. That whole like intellectual class that came up around that time were really driven, I think, by that failure. You know, I talked about Ben, my former podcast partner, who's now, you know, had a digital for the USA. I can, you know, I think it's long enough now that we can recall or we can tell you how Ben reacted to the 8-1 game. At one point, he stood up and whipped a pint glass across the bar. That's the anger that day created. was palatable and really, I think, drove change. So that's how you positively put it. It was a really bad day. I mean, I've never been in a bar that a packed bar that quiet in my life. And it wasn't sadness. I mean, there was some sadness in there. It was mostly anger, like low level. How dare you play with me? Why would you do this to me? And it seemed personal for the Voyagers at that point, because it felt like, bluntly, we cared more than the people on the pitch. That was the only time I ever felt ashamed to follow this program, because they lied down. They lied down and exposed their belly. It's fine to lose down there. You go down, you lose 3-0. That sucks, but at least you played. 8-1, there's no excuse for that. And there needed to be an absolute blow up of the program, and there was. I know there's a lot of people that want more change, and they want change faster and all that sort of stuff, and I get that frustration. But the reality is, you know, it starts with just a realization, and that realization happened that night. It's not even a question to me, Kevin. It was the single most defining moment of the decade. It was not a positive one, as you say, but it was absolutely defining. It led to everything that followed.
So, full disclosure, Dwayne and I made this list. It's mostly Dwayne that put together. You asked me, Kevin, what do you have? And I'm like, Dwayne, I can pretty much agree with any one of these, as long as Samper Dasula is number one. It's the defining moment of the decade. Good or bad, it doesn't matter. When you think about 2010s in Canadian soccer, yes, the Davies is going to be remembered as beginning. But for a Canadian men's national team or a Canadian women's national team, for a moment, like the top moment that stands out in my mind for good or bad reasons, it's that one. I was at Scrappé in Montreal, and I've seen a few people leave really angry. Not a lot of things were said. A few things were thrown. Back then, they still had like coasters and stuff. I've seen a few of them throw. There was not a lot of us watching that game. And since then, it's never been the same either. The Voyagers as an entity has lost something. It is for me that day, the day of the 8-1. Like, I feel bad for Ian Yu. Maybe scored the nicest goal of his entire career. No one is ever going to talk about his goal, like his freaky goal that he scored in that game. And no one cares. It's the 8 that you let in that actually hurts.
Yeah. It was just ugly. I mean, it was just ugly, and there's no excuse to it. I mean, there's other shocking results happen, but this, and if it was just an outlier shocking result, you'd be like, okay, well, you move on. Like Brazil lost 7-1. We talked about that in the world list. Well, sort of. We alluded to it in the world list. They bounced from that, though, because it was an outlier. You know, it was an outlier that was based on the pressure and Neymar's injury and a whole bunch of stuff that went on in that World Cup that sort of created this vacuum that allowed a very good Germany team to take advantage of it. But in Canada's case, it was absolutely, you know, it was when the disease started to show you know, you have a disease, but you don't show any symptoms. And then one day you wake up with a mole on your head the size of a rock. Well, the mole appeared that day, right? Like, finally it bubbled up to the surface, and there was no ignoring the rot anymore, and you had to go to a doctor and start to fix it. And unfortunately, the treatments are going to take a lot longer than 5, 6, 7, 10 years. It's going to be ongoing, but I think that it has started. And you know, the only other candidate for number one on this list would be Campiel starting, but to me, Campiel doesn't start without the 8-1 loss.
Without the 8-1, yeah. Well, you had to hit bottom before you start climbing up again. And that moment was rock bottom for Canadian Soccer Association, especially for the Canadian men's national team. And that day in 2012?
It must have been 2012, yeah. For 2014, yeah.
At the end of 2012. So, that day in Samper Dasula is, unfortunately, our number one moment or story in the top 10 Canadian soccer moments of the decade. Hope you enjoyed your time with us on New Year's Day. Hope you enjoyed our list. As always, you can follow us on social media at 24th Minute for Dwayne, at Kevin Larmer for myself. And I would like to wish you all a happy New Year, if New Year's Day is something for you. Majority of the people do follow the Gregorian calendar, Dwayne. So I do anticipate this applies to a lot of you. But for Dwayne, for myself, and everyone at SPN, we wish you a happy new year, and we'll see you sometime in 2020.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.